2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 311, Leadership Without Leaders, Lessons for Mormonism from an Orchestra with No Conductor, a paper presented by Michael J. Stevens, with a response by Gordon Banks.
That the start button has been hit. Good morning, everybody. We're glad you're here for this particular session. And we are hearing today from Mike Stevens, who is a professor of management at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. And the most important thing we need to know about Mike is that his highest church calling is assistant nursery leader, for which we are very grateful. Highest and holiest, I forgot that. The respondent to today's presentation will be Gordon Banks, who is a PhD, MD in physics. He has his PhD and is a neurologist, currently in general neurology practice in Yamhill County, Oregon, and is an avid banjo player, and I don't know what his highest and holiest church calling is. That's another good one. And I served in the Sunday school, so hey, you've got a good plethora there. So without further ado,
well, thank you. It's good to see it. At least a few of us can actually be counted as early morning people on a Saturday. Thank you. I'll begin with a question, and as we proceed this morning, try to answer it in a variety of different ways. Is Mormonism a religious movement with a prophet, or is it a prophetic movement? Is it a religion where God wants the many to be led in all things exclusively by the one true leader? That is it to have a prophet with a capital P? Or is its vision rather that of a movement where individuals are encouraged to take prophetic responsibility for themselves and their stewardships? That is it to have prophets with a small case P? Clearly, Moses had the latter vision in mind, though he didn't dismiss the importance of the former when he was confronted with a potential challenge to his leadership, to his priesthood leadership and authority in the 11th chapter of Numbers. There we read that Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord and gathered them and set them around the tabernacle. And the Lord came down in a cloud and spake unto him and took of the Spirit that was upon him and gave it unto them. And it came to pass that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied and did not cease. But there remained two in the camp, and the Spirit rested upon them, and they prophesied in the camp. And there ran a young man and told Moses and said, two men prophesy in the camp. And Joshua, the servant of Moses, answered and said, my lord Moses, forbid them. And Moses said unto them, enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. In this passage of the Old Testament, Moses obviously is not jealous about sharing the prophetic function. Indeed, he appears clearly to be in favor of opening up the prophetic task within Israel to more than just himself. What I have in mind doing this morning is to explore this notion by drawing on some insights from the world of music making. Many of us here have heard, or perhaps even used in talks and lessons ourselves, the analogy comparing the church to a symphony orchestra, where the individual members are like the musicians, operating under the direction of a wise and omnipotent conductor who alone sees and understands the overall scope and vision of the music to be performed. The argument goes that, like the church, an orchestra is, after all, a community of interconnected people dedicated to achieving a high degree of unanimity or harmony that is all but impossible to achieve without that strong, central, unifying vision and organizational direction from the conductor. According to this model, the strong leadership of a conductor is not only proper and needed, but is also indispensable. For without it, there would be a chaotic cacophony rather than sweetly performed music. As evidence for the validity of this view, we are told to note that virtually every major orchestra in the world operates according to this model of an all-powerful conductor, with musicians who are there to carry out the conductor's vision of how the music should be played. This is especially true as the music, the musicians, and the instrumentations become more complex and sophisticated. Apparently, this system works, because even the most miserably unhappy and beaten down musicians can produce wonderful music this way. For those who have little or no experience performing under a conductor, either with an orchestra or possibly even choral music groups as well, it's easy to think that the job of a conductor involves little more than simply standing in front of the musicians, beating out the time with the baton. However, this is only a very minor aspect of the conductor's job. Instead, the main duties and responsibilities of the conductor are to make the decisions concerning not only the program and repertoire, but to determine the overall vision of how a particular piece of music is to be played, which is perhaps the single most important aspect of control and coordination of the conductor. In addition, the conductor must communicate that vision to the musicians and then, through rehearsal, to somehow ensure that the musicians are properly prepared and inspired to enact or perform his interpretive vision. By way of example of how this is done, I want to show two short clips from documentaries of the world-renowned conductor Zubin Mehta. The first is a short video clip of Maestro Mehta with his orchestra members at the Los Angeles Philharmonic some years back when he was the conductor there. The second clip I'm going to show is a more recent interview with the maestro towards now the twilight years of his career, where he shares his view and understanding of the nature and role of the conductor in an orchestra. So I'll take a few minutes, share these clips, and then jump back into a little more discussion. The video segment goes on, and it's about 20 or 30 minute documentary, but it then goes on to show a few interspersed segments where the maestro is in rehearsal with his musicians, essentially dictating, albeit benevolently, how the woodwinds need to play, how they need to be a little bit louder, and how the strings need to come in more on cue and articulate phrases in different sorts of ways. This is the real work of the conductor. I'm going to switch real quick to an interview that's a more recent depiction of the maestro's understanding of what conductors are all about.
The individual musician is too busy making music of the 20th century.
Despite the democratic preferences that are perhaps held by many of us here this morning, I think it's necessary to concede that there are some benefits that derive from these traditional top-down heroic leadership structures that we find used in most symphony orchestras. For example, these autocratic types of structures do in fact help us establish order by minimizing chaos and confusion. Indeed, this is identical to the very work of God that God does through the creation process, which is to bring order out of chaos. In addition, these structures also help us enhance the efficient use of time and other resources, which are ultimately always finite and in limited supply. These structures also help us provide stability, predictable, and consistency. And such an environment can be a wonderfully safe and secure place wherein musicians are free to participate in the process of making beautiful music together. The following quote that I'm going to read is a confession of this joy drawn from an interview with a musician named Amy Oshiro, a newly hired member of the string section of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. She notes the following, quote, "People often ask me what it's like to sit on the stage as a member of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. Thrilling is the first word that comes to mind. It is also a privilege. I feel honored to sit among some of the finest musicians in the country and to perform with them week after week. The sounds that I hear created on this stage are world-class and inspire me. One of the best things a musician can experience is the joy that is achieved when a performance goes particularly well or when the piece you are playing consumes you completely. It's as if time stops and all that remains are the sounds swirling around you, taking over and pushing aside everything else. The orchestra seems to work magically, as if all of us are on one level together. When that happens to me, I forget that this is a job. It is a feeling that I would have always hoped for, regardless of whether I could make it a living. Those are the moments that make it worth the long haul to become a professional musician." End quote. I'm certain that such descriptions of the immense satisfaction professional musicians derive from performing as part of a larger, highly coordinated group are no doubt true. There is, however, also a dark side to this traditional, autocratic, top-down organizational style, as many of us here perhaps know too well. For one thing, such organizational structures, cultures, and leadership styles paradoxically wreak havoc with the morale of the individual musicians. This is evidenced by the fact that professional orchestra musicians often tell conductor jokes, much the way the rest of us tell lawyer jokes. In fact, sometimes they combine the two, such as when they ask, "If you take a lawyer and a conductor to the top of a tall building and push them both off at the same time, which one will hit the ground first?" The answer? Who cares, so long as you push them both off. This systematically low morale among professional symphony musicians can be seen when general employment satisfaction survey data is compared across all groups of workers in the U.S. economy. Professional symphony musicians are consistently one of the lowest ranking professional groups in the surveys, usually in a dead heat with commercial airline pilots at the bottom of the list. But interestingly, with the airline pilots, it's just a subsection of that group, involving those whose careers began by flying high-performance military jet aircraft. For these pilots, their unexpectedly poor job satisfaction ratings is easily explained when one examines the nature of the flying they do. Pilots of high-performance military jet aircraft typically describe that job in terms of it being thrilling, adrenaline-laden, macho rush, whereas the job of flying commercial jet aircraft is often referred to simply as little more than being a glorified bus driver. Going from the former to the latter for these pilots is a tremendous letdown, which is quite naturally reflected in the lower job satisfaction ratings. With professional musicians, their lower ratings of job satisfaction are also explained when one examines the nature of the musician's typical career path. In her interview, Amy O'Shiro, this newly hired member of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, described it this way. Quote, "It takes a lifetime of dedication before a musician can get to the point of becoming a performer with a leading orchestra. I've studied the violin since I was 3 years old, growing up in suburban Chicago. And over the years, I grudgingly practiced, even when I didn't want to. As a teenager, I gained a better sense of what it might be like to perform for a living and decided to pursue music as a career. By the time I was headed for college, I knew for sure that I wanted a future on the stage. After many years of conservatory and college, like thousands of music students before me, I started taking auditions. Although I wasn't optimistic, I signed up for the auditions in St. Louis, and on a very lucky day for me, I won a spot." End quote. When she applied, Amy was among 700 applicants for the one opening in the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra string section. Half of those were people who had very prestigious musical pedigrees, background, and talent, having come from schools equivalent of Juilliard and the like. The great irony in this whole process is that in order for musicians to achieve a level of mastery over their instruments such that they are serious competitors for these top symphony jobs, they must become great individual artists who have not only mastered the playing of their instruments, but who have also mastered the interpretive and intuitive expressions that they must put into any given performance. Then, at the peak of this individual performing and interpretive mastery, they join a symphony orchestra where they must then turn around and completely surrender not only all that musical individuality, but also control over the choice of repertoire and the overall vision for how a particular piece of music is to be played. Can you see why their morale as a group is so systematically low? If not for the joy of the music making, and I would add also, if not for the much higher than average wages they receive as symphony musicians, at least by musician standards, there would be far fewer of them who pursue such a career path. But poor morale is not the only dark side of these traditional autocratic top-down organizational structures for musicians. There are others. For example, strongly autocratic leadership goes hand in hand with organizational cultures, precisely wherein people are discouraged, even punished, for challenging, questioning, and taking the initiative, and instead are conditioned, even rewarded, for waiting to be commanded in all things. It thus stifles creativity and innovation. Such structures and leadership approaches also have no interest in facilitating collaboration or commitment, but instead are quite content with exacting compliance, regardless of the cost. And this has the inevitable effect of separating the musicians from virtually any sense of ownership or personal responsibility for the music. Finally, such managerial approaches also have the corollary that these approaches typically use fear to motivate, such as in situations where we hear a conductor say something along the lines of, "My way or the highway." And they have no sense of the benefit that can be derived from fostering the intrinsic motivation that leads to high levels of personal commitment and ownership in the musicians. So, there we have it, these two conflicting alternatives. We seem to be stuck with what is called a Hobbesian choice. Do you want chaos or tyranny to reign in your orchestra? Or are those the only choices? Is there perhaps an alternative we haven't considered, such as whether an orchestra has to have a conductor at all to lead and shape the performance of its musicians? The answer appears to be a most definite yes, although my guess is that artists like Zubin Mehta would disagree. We heard him just say, "Someone has to be in charge." There is, however, an alternative. Let me introduce you to the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra through the following short segment from a documentary film about what they call the Orpheus process.
conducted.
Thank you.
the conductors are always leashed, almost always. Unless the conductor is great or an idiot. In work, it's energy that's there that doesn't get leashed. It's there and then it starts to go.
It requires a degree of trust, then the group begins to function.
As I watch this example, a number of key features jump out at me. For example, the music-making process in Orpheus has leadership. Music has to have leadership. But with the Orpheus Orchestra, the issue is not so much that they don't have a conductor, but rather that they have 26 conductors. With one conductor, musicians abdicate a huge part of their individual responsibility. Second feature is that every musician is a source for inspiration, and every musician therefore feels personal responsibility. All musicians have a voice and feel that their opinions are not only respected but actually put into play. In addition, there's a structure and order. There are concert masters for each piece, and each section of the orchestra as well has what they call core leaders. Another feature is that these are incredibly capable musicians, not just in terms of their talent, but also in terms of their social maturity. I'm quick to concede that the Orpheus process would not work with your typical high school orchestra. My final observation, Orpheus's rehearsals are a very messy process, yet it also has structure. But it is an empowering structure wherein every musician has a voice. Now, I don't know what your reaction to this Orpheus example is, but if you're like me, then you probably see it as an attractive, perhaps even wonderfully empowering alternative to the autocratic conductor. But is it possible? Is it practical? Is it achievable? And if so, what sorts of challenges do we face in making it come alive? For a number of years, I've been teaching about the Orpheus process as one element in a leadership and team building course for experienced MBA students. After they've been introduced to this alternative model to leadership, and we have had some healthy discussion of its pros and cons, I asked them to write a short essay on whether or not they think it is possible to implement the Orpheus approach in their own real-life organizations, and to justify their answers one way or the other. The results? About two-thirds or more say that it's not possible, even though these musicians that they see seem to have been able to do it. About 20% of the students think it's possible, but it would be very, very difficult, and the remainder simply aren't sure one way or the other. For those experienced MBA students who say it's not possible to follow the Orpheus model in their real-life organizations, some think that it's all just a PR stunt for a video. But the most commonly cited reason they give to justify their pessimism is that someone has to be in charge. I'll come back to that in just a minute. First, I want to set up a short summary and conclusion by providing a list of factors that I call my list of things that keep the Orpheus approach from being implemented and succeeding in real-life organizations. This list is broken into two categories. One, things related to followers or musicians, and two, things related to the leaders or conductors. For followers, the things on my list include, number one, whatever the task at hand is, the followers must have all the technical expertise and maturity needed for a mastery performance. That is, they must have the knowledge, skills, and abilities that will allow them the proficiency and expertise to know what to do, when to do it, and how to do it without being told by a conductor. In a related fashion, they must also have the willingness to do what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, and how it needs to be done. In many ways, what we're talking about here is good old emotional intelligence in the form of maturity, self-discipline, and self-regulation. Finally, they must also have a mastery of interpersonal skills that is at a level not all commonly held by most people in general. These interpersonal skills consist specifically of such things as the ability to resolve
conflict effectively, collaborate on problem solving, listening, communication skills, and so on. For leaders, the things that would appear on the list would be, for one thing, leaders must have an awareness of the possibilities. That is, they must have a mental model or belief system that allows for the possibility that an Orpheus-style approach can work. When people claim that someone has to be in charge, what they're actually saying is quite simply that they don't understand what the possibilities are, or at least they don't believe that it's possible. Leaders must also be willing to let go of the desire for order above all else. Note that I'm not saying that they must let go of the desire for order, but that they must let go of the desire for order above all else. However, this brings risk into the process, but that risk is what provides breathing space for creativity and innovation, and yes, even individual agency to flourish. Like the individual followers, leaders must also have a mastery of interpersonal skills, conflict resolution skills, collaborative problem-solving, decision-making skills, listening and communication skills, and so on. In addition, leaders must also have an accurate self-awareness with regard to their own behavioral and leadership style. This is an especially difficult requirement because we all, including leaders, tend to judge ourselves by our motives and intentions rather than by the actual impact of our behavior and interpersonal style. Objective feedback on such matters is essential. In addition, leaders must have the capacity and willingness to let go of their egos. This is a big one, especially in the world of professional music making. Members of Orpheus state quite plainly that those who have egos that need to be stroked simply will not survive within the Orpheus system. In a related manner, leaders must also be motivated by a desire to serve the greater good of the community. That is, to feed the sheep rather than feed upon the sheep. Like ego, personal greed and ambition will destroy an empowerment culture. Finally, leaders must also understand that pure and noble paternalistic motives, however noble they may be, must be limited to an appropriate time and place. In the words of Scott Barchi, quote, "One of the real problems with hierarchical structures is that they seek to keep grown-up people as children until they die. And most of this is a power the psychoanalyst Roland May isolates five different bases of power." I'm going to end with this real quickly here. Turn the time over to Gordon. Make sure we got enough for response. The first is control power, which uses force and coercion in order to get others to comply. This is the typical source of power that males in American society are socialized into. The second is manipulative power, which involves the use of tricks, gaming, scheming, and so on to get one's way. In a male-dominated culture, this is the tactic primarily used by women, but also to a fairly large extent by men who find themselves left outside of the power grab. Third is competitive power, which is somewhat similar to control power, but different in that it does not necessarily wish to dominate or rule over others, but simply strives to outdo or outmaneuver others in competition for a fixed set of resources. Fourth is nutritive power, which is what we see between parents and children. This style of power is actually quite good and healthy and proper, but only when used at the right time and in the right place and during the right period of growth. That is, it clearly becomes inappropriate at some point when the child or the subordinate or follower reaches a level of growth and maturity where independence and autonomy are called for. At that point, you have to let go of nutritive power, otherwise it becomes sick. Finally, Rollo May identifies integrative power, which he describes as power that is used by those who have it for the sake and benefit of others, without any interest or concern for what the person in control is going to get out of it himself. This is in essence what we mean today when we use the term empowerment. Empowerment does not mean that we give up our power, but that we use whatever power and gifts we have for the sake and benefit of others rather than ourselves. That last kind of power, integrated power, is the kind that leads to the healthy interdependence that is a prerequisite for groups or organizations such as Orpheus to not only survive but to thrive, whereas the other four will almost invariably lead to unhealthy dependence or cause for submission on the one hand, or unhealthy independence, which is the traditional American way. So the goal or the challenge is to avoid this dysfunctional dependence and independence and instead strive to attain the healthy balance of interdependence. When one thinks of conductors working with young, inexperienced musicians, a certain degree of paternalistic, nutritive power may be very appropriate. However, as the follower or musician grows and develops, this exercise of nutritive power can quickly become a hindrance. Likewise, our lives in the church follow an analogous pattern. While the exercise of nutritive power by a benevolent patriarch may make sense when people are young and immature in their spirituality, it is an approach that will serve to hinder the spiritually mature in their journey towards the full measure of perfection found in Christ. This is not only true of the individual, but also of the community it fosters. In his essay, Considerations on Representative Government, John Stuart Mill challenges the arguments in favor of benevolent dictatorship. He argues that even in the most humane of instances, such a system will invariably create a social group where, quote, one man of elevated mental activity will end up managing the entire affairs of a mentally passive people, end quote. For Mill, that arrangement was simply intolerable. Although the chaos of a leaderless organization is no acceptable substitute, those of us here today know of at least one more alternative that may prove desirable. Thank you.
Well, I guess I don't need too much time because I agree with most of what Michael said. It's the nature, I think, of human beings, or at least many of them, and you don't need to have everybody want it, but all you need is a large percentage to want to gain power. I think that's especially true of males. It can occur in females, too, and if you can see this in female organizations as well as male, but it's much more prominent among males. They want to have power, and I think it's biologically based. I think in our civilized institutions, we do very well to try to limit the power of any individual. And the more we can limit it, the better. You see, all of the institutions where hierarchical structures exist, allowing people to have too much power destroys them. A good example is the Roman Republic. They had a rule in there that you could have a dictator. The dictator could only be a dictator for a year, and there had to be a specific purpose for that dictatorship, like to win a war or something. Well, ultimately that led to the destruction of the Roman Republic because the people who became the dictators, so let's make it one more year. And they also gathered all these armies, and their army structure allowed them to completely subvert the... It wasn't purely democratic, but it was, there was a semblance of democracy there, and that certain people could make decisions prior to that. You see this in the military. Military is probably the most hierarchical structure we have in our society, but in their ambition to get to the top, we end up with inter-service rivalries. We end up with things that destroy the effectiveness of the military. We see this in our political system. The more power people can have, the longer they can stay in office, the more corrupt they can become. Just to use the musical example, this is a very, in a way, this kind of music is not, this is a very structured and, in a way, abnormal music. Most people, before the time that we had radio and records, were musicians themselves. Everybody took part, unless they were tone deaf or and couldn't do any music, but most people can. The kind of music we choose to make with each other, you would never submit to this kind of organization. You know, the kind of music that I play, for instance, is the Southern Appalachian tradition. And there, if you play, you can play alone, of course, but if you play in an ensemble, everybody has a certain responsibility. For instance, the fiddler usually has the responsibility for keeping the melody And he may choose the melody to be a little different, and it's up to the banjo player to play notes that go with that melody, but to set the rhythm. The banjo player may kick the fiddler a little faster or hold the fiddler back. If you add a bass or a guitar, then they are rhythm instruments too. There's no talking about that usually. You start playing, and you kind of have to know what to do. You play, if you try to play with musicians of your same level, and if somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to, well, then they have to go somewhere else to play next time because people won't want to play with them. But there's no one saying, oh, no, let's change this. There's no rehearsal. You sit down, you play, and you either get into a groove or you don't. And it's mutual. It's a mutual thing. My experience with hierarchies is, I'm not talking about the church here, but you can draw your own conclusions, has been with the academic world, including my training. Probably I've been 25 years in the academic world. The leaders that are truly effective, the most effective chief I ever had, was someone who was totally not autocratic, but he was so charismatic and loved and good at what he did. All it took from him was saying, Gordon, I wouldn't ever do this. And I never wanted to do that again. He never said, don't ever do that. A chief who does that, all right, you're still not going to do it again because you don't want him down on you. But you're not going to be as effective. You're not striving to be like him and to do everything right to please him. And I think that's the kind of leader that can be in a hierarchical system and yet not, and yet have good morale on the part of his followers. We had a very good chairman at the university that I was at for about 10 years. Everybody liked him. He wasn't autocratic. He tried to do things by mutual consent. He considered the department as being for the good of everyone. Everyone would benefit. And we wanted to do a good job. We wanted the students to learn. We wanted the residents to learn. We wanted to have good research, and we wanted to do good teaching and take good care of the patients. Then, as financial pressures started to build up with the cutbacks, he wasn't acceptable anymore because he wasn't making enough money. Well, so there went we had a practice plan where we got a share of whatever income we earned from seeing patients. Well, the higher up said, all right, no more practice plans for people who aren't making as much money as I think they should. So they cut that out. They put in a tyrant over us. Now I left in 97, and there's only one or two people of the whole department still there. Everyone left. They're doing much worse than they were. That kind of leadership was not effective because it was directed from higher up, and the goals were to build them up, make them more powerful, make it the most powerful hospital in the region. They would buy up doctors, and they would then have to send their patients to that hospital. It totally destroyed the morale of the people, and it was no fun to work there anymore. And the only people still working there are the ones that had no alternative but to leave. They had either their health problems or they had children that had to stay in the community. So I think it's almost always bad to give too much power to any individuals. This collaborative way, I mentioned one other thing. In Denmark, I was visiting a professor there. They elect the department chairman. And even the secretaries have a vote as to who becomes department chairman. The department chairman that I saw there were very good. They were just as good academically as our department chairman, but they were nice. They weren't the kinds that we often get here because they weren't selected from above as somebody who is going to help the guy upstairs. They were selected by the people that they were over. And therefore, they got people who were nice. Or they wouldn't be elected as chairman. But they were effective. You wouldn't want someone as your chairman who wasn't effective. Anyway, so I think we can see how this could apply to other organizations. Whether it will, I don't think. I think it's always going to be a struggle. There's always going to be the tendency of people to want power, and most of the people that are most unethical are the ones that tend to migrate to the top. It's a lot easier to get to the top if you're not ethical. It really is. And so we maybe have 5% of the people in the population that are very unethical, and yet 30% of the ones at the top are very unethical, which is a shame. But that's all I have to say.
We're a monstrous crowd today. If any of you have questions, please come up here to the mic so it can be part of the tape, okay? Thank you.
And before I have to depart, I want to thank the presenter and responder very much. There is a lot of food to pop here.
I just wanted to make a brief comment. I sing in the Utah Symphony Chorus, and therefore have an opportunity to sing with Keith Lockhart on a number of occasions, and he's considered one of the best, even though most of the time he's an autocratic sort of leader. You know, I mean, he can be quietly mean. But people respect him because they know that he's got tremendous ability, that he's a genius, and that he knows exactly where all the sounds are coming from and where it's supposed to come from. And so you assume that most of the time you need his direction. But I've been interested in the case of just a few times when we had trouble getting a certain section of the piece right. And after he'd worked on it three or four times, he said, "Okay, now I'm just not going to conduct this. I'm just going to step aside and let you do it." And he went down in the audience and let us start when we wanted to. And then he says, "Okay, do it again." And by doing it about three times, we worked out the kinks. And so he came up and he said, "Now the key here is that you have to count the notes, the beats, if you don't have a conductor that you depend on. Sometimes you're too dependent on the conductor, and you're not careful enough about your own musical skills. And so when we have a difficult portion like that, you know I'm not going to lead you, and so you concentrate more on the music itself, and it comes out better." I thought that was interesting.
If there are no other comments or questions, step forward.
I'm not sure that this comment belongs in this particular session, but I wanted to ask it anyway. Have you ever looked at the correlation between what you presented here and the idea of the Quorum of the Anointed that Joseph Smith started as a higher body that had been more schooled, say, to the professional level that you have equated with orchestra members that are very capable in their ability to function in, say, the Kingdom of God organization, which was, or the Council of 50 or other things like that, where they were not, where they were all required to be of the same. Anyway, would you comment on that?
Well, at a general level, as I understand it, we'd be talking essentially as a presiding or governing group that was ideally supposed to be a body of equals. But as we all know in organizational lives, some animals are more equal than others. The vision I've developed over the years of a Zion society is one of healthy interdependence. And I mentioned that towards the end. I didn't really get into a discussion of that. But any time, as we're told in D&C 121, any time you give a little authority to someone, they immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion, compulsion. And that it's not just some men, it's not just a lot of men, it is almost all men who fall, and I think he's saying mankind, because I've seen some fairly tyrannical primary presidents and nursery leaders and even mothers and sisters and so on. Certainly that's true in the corporate world where women are leaders. So it's a universal tendency. That kind of compulsion leads to very predictable behavioral responses from people upon whom it is exercised. Behavioral responses of compliance. But that's on a really good day. More likely than not, coercion is going to foster resistance, whether active or passive. The only kind of leadership style that fosters design community is the inverted pyramid leadership style that we see laid out for us in the New Testament. Many people call that servant leadership nowadays. It is not subservient leadership, it is servant leadership. It is not the giving up of power, but the use and exercise of one's power and gifts to build up others, to build up community, build bridges, get people to reconcile, remove divisions, and so on. There's a wonderful, wonderful paradox in what Jesus says, when the first shall be last and the last shall be first. A true servant leader who is first puts the needs of the flock first and himself or herself last. And in so doing, paradoxically creates a society and a vision and a community of people wherein his vision or her vision of goodness and righteousness prevail in the end. Whereas the autocrat who puts himself or herself first, in the end, ends up last, ends up with an organization that has been destroyed through greed, through ambition, through individual objective and self-aggrandizement. So the autocrats who indeed put themselves first really do come in last. And those servant leaders who follow the New Testament model and put themselves last in the end are the only ones left standing, and indeed are first. So that's a very general answer to your challengingly specific question, but that's probably all we have time for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your attendance, and enjoy the rest of Sunstone today.
Yeah, in the sense of formal leadership.
Oh, that's good.